live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. My guest today, it's kind of a story. Hey, I want to go out and find a guest, right? And I say to myself, you know, I work through all these different people that want to get celebrities. But I said, you know what? I saw a book. I said, hey, I'm going to go contact the publisher and get them on the show. Well, I should have just walked all the way down, or I mean, drove like about 20 minutes from my house to where he is. But hey, I had to go through his publisher. But I'm so excited to welcome the program author and celebrity Dave Hansen, Slapshot, the original. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing great. Let's set the record straight, just in case your listeners get confused. The book that I authored, although that's probably what they expected, it's not a coloring book. It's actually got words in it.
And I'm sure when people that are fans of Slapshot would say, you authored something, especially based on the movie. Really? So your life story is amazing, and it's your memoir. And you got to be just blown away that someone asked you to write a book, right?
Well, you know, the funny thing, it started out with a fellow by the name of Ross Bernstein, who is out of Minnesota that's what he does. He writes sport books, and a lot of it is published through Triumph, and he's a big hockey fan and a hockey nut. He tried out for the Minnesota Gophers as a player, didn't make it, but became their mascot. So still he's a frustrated hockey player and goes out and plays. So he wrote a book called The Code, which was the code related to hockey, and gave me a call because I guess he felt I had something to add. And he did his regular interview, but through the process, we just kept talking and talking. And then he finally, after all said and done, he says, you know, you ought to write your own book. You got quite a bit of stories there. And so for quite some time, I just, you know, put it on the shelf and didn't think anything about it. But as I sat around, you know, the Hans brothers go out and have been for quite some time doing a lot of charity events and traveling North America and even over into Europe. I had that mentioned to me a couple of times, so I just out of the blue, I gave this fellow Ross Bernstein a call. He says, you know, do you really think I should write a book? He says, absolutely. I said, okay, how do we do that? And then he kind of laid it down and found a publisher in Triumph Books, and I wrote the book, and it was off and running.
Amazing. Amazing when you talk about it. Now you have to look back at your life and say to yourself, growing up in tough neighborhoods when you grew up, you probably never thought that you would be this celebrity that was in a successful movie and ultimately had a hockey career as well. You probably growing up, you didn't think this was going to happen, did you?
Well, you know, I think that celebrity term you use is, you know, whether it's a celebrity in my own mind or someone else's mind, that can be debated. But I grew up in a neighborhood where it was an inner city kind of thing, and loved sports. You know, it was Minnesota, so, you know, the longest season of the year is winter, so, you know, a lot of lakes up there and a lot of ice and snow, so skating was just kind of an inherited trait that most of the kids did, and so we skated a lot, but I also played football and baseball, and ironically loved football more than hockey, and actually loved baseball, playing baseball more than hockey, and thought I'd end up, you know, going in that direction in the college, but got recruited by Herbie Brooks. You know, the he was a very persuasive and at that time very influential high profile person in the Twin City area. It was his first year as coach of the Minnesota Gophers, and decided to go there and play hockey. But you know, back to your original question, no, you know, you grow up, you play sports, you live your life, and you just kind of follow the path as it kind of led me along, and along the way I had a lot of fun, and that, you know, that was one of the reasons that I wrote the book, was kind of an idea that, hey, you know what, there's some stories there that I know I enjoy telling. My family would probably enjoy reading some of it that they don't know about. And as I continue to get older and lose lose more and more of my memory, at least there'll be something in writing that I can reflect on and pass along.
So tell me a little bit about your household. What type of a household? How was the Hansen house, and what was the normal everyday occurrence? Did you grow up in a middle-class family?
Yeah, I guess you could say lower to middle class. You know, back then, you know, my dad was worked at an auto parts warehouse. My mom worked in a press shop, and so you know, I had working parents. And in the neighborhood that I grew up, I guess you could say there was kind of three sections. There was, you know, those that lived down on the flats and in the projects, and then those that lived kind of in the middle of the hill, and then the rest that lived up on the top of the hill. And we were kind of at the lower part of the middle of the hill, and certainly was never a child that needed, you know, was in want of anything that my parents didn't provide for, but, you know, we weren't to either extreme as well. So it was a great childhood. I had a younger brother and two sisters and a great neighborhood. It was, you know, where everybody knew everybody, hung out. You know, I had the privilege, which a lot of people families don't get anymore because it's so, a lot of families are very transient, but I had the privilege of growing up in a neighborhood where kind of everybody knew everybody and went to grade school with them and went to middle school with them and went to high school with them. So it was a great great atmosphere and a great childhood.
So great childhood. Then you end up at Minnesota to play hockey, and the experience then of playing, and I guess also being under such a legend of a coach, you never would have thought that either at the point when he recruited you as Herbie Brooks.
Well, yeah, and it was, you know, of course, this was pre-1980 USA Hockey winning the gold championships. You know, Herbie was kind of a city legend, you know, St. Paul guy that went to the University of Minnesota himself, and I think was probably the last cut from the Olympic team, you know, back when he was playing in his youthful days, and played, had a good career at the university, and then went into coaching locally. And when he got the job at the University of Minnesota, it was his first year as well as my first year going in. So, you know, for him recruiting me, it wasn't, you know, the Herb Brooks that everybody knows now. It was just Herb Brooks, first year coach at the University of Minnesota, you know, a good hockey coach in St. Paul. The ideal thing was, you know, every boy that played hockey in Minnesota had dreams of one day playing for the Minnesota Gophers. So I had other opportunities, even an opportunity to go play college football, which, again, you know, it was a first love of mine. But, you know, when you got Herbie Brooks and the opportunity to be a Gopher staring you in the face, it certainly wasn't anything that I wanted to turn down. And Herbie gave me an opportunity to get a start there.
And a lot of people, when they think about you just as this fighter from the movie, I mean, when you mention the Hansons, especially yourself, they think about, you know, the rough and tumble fighting type of hockey player who wouldn't take anything from anyone. When you were playing in Minnesota, were you a finesse player, or were you pretty rough style playing in Minnesota?
Well, I was kind of I played in the St. Paul City Conference, which was city schools. So, you know, growing up in that network and in that environment, I was kind of like the big fish in a small pond. The city conference and certainly St. Paul Humboldt, the high school I went to, you know, hockey, well, everybody played it. And there were some real powerhouses, especially over on the east side coming out of conference and some good players coming out, moving on to college. Humboldt was not one of them. You know, there was no players ever coming out of Humboldt with the exception of Kenny Yackel, who was a legend and went on to be a three-sport athlete at the University of Minnesota and from Humboldt and then had a professional career. You know, I was the only one to come out of there and have an opportunity to as a hockey player and go move on through a scholarship. Now, ironically, the scholarship that I got was not, I did not get an athletic scholarship. You know, Herbie recruited me And even though he says, you know, I can offer you an athletic scholarship, I'd be happy to do so, but, you know, you are eligible for a scholastic scholarship. And so I got a full ride as a scholastic scholarship going to the University of Minnesota. So, you know, back to the original question, although I guess you could say I was, I was a good skater, and like I said, big fish in small pond. So, you know, I was like the leading scorer of the team and so forth.
Wow.
You know, the part that I love most about my game was the physical play. So really, when I got to the university, which was very high tempo, puck control, high skills, you know, Herbie, you know, at that time, well, I should say at that time, University of Minnesota only recruited Minnesota players. But Minnesota was the hockey hotbed of amateur hockey. So, you know, players from all over Minnesota were coming to the U, and you know, some of the top players in the state. So I kind of came in as a physical player, and, you know, when compared to the majority of those players, I was not a skilled player, and that kind of led to my frustration at the university, because I quite candidly was not good enough my first year as a true freshman at 18 years old to make the varsity squad. So I got stuck on the junior varsity squad, which was kind of demoralizing. Even though we would train with the varsity, when it came game time, you know, I didn't dress up. So, you know, after a year and a half of that, you know, my patience wore thin, but Herbie's did not. But I just simply said, you know, if I'm not going to play in the varsity, I want to go a different route. And so I quit the university and jumped into juniors and played another year and a half of juniors and then turned pro.
Interesting. So you really, again, I guess this was the kind of track that started a lot of them that you don't always ultimately play in college for hockey. People decide, hey, you left and want to go back specifically your intelligence. An academic scholarship? I mean, Dave, again, bringing that up, especially the Hansons, an academic scholarship? This is completely blowing your cover, you know?
Yeah, doesn't that blow you away, huh? I agree. It was... But, you know, to tell the truth, I was an honor roll student, had great teachers in high school, had great guidance by my parents that were involved, and it worked out. So, yeah, I went on a full academic ride to the university. You look back on things and you wonder, you know, what, if you have any regrets, and I really have few in my life, but one of them was that I did not follow through and hang in there and get a college degree. But on the flip side of that, my life still turned out great, you know, leaving school and taking a different route.
Okay, so you play in the juniors, and the juniors is like a place where it's almost like the minor leagues of the minor leagues. They see that you have talent, then you get go up to the minors. And in hockey, is that how it works professionally? The juniors?
Yeah, junior hockey then is similar to what it is now, though it's more pronounced now, and it's used more as a developmental league for the next level. And the next level out of junior is typically, in the United States, it's college. And in Canada, tier two level, it's college. But in Canada, tier one level, it's pro. So it's the prelude to either moving on to college and playing college hockey or moving into the professional ranks.
Okay, when we get back, we're going to go more with Dave Hansen. And again, Dave says, I was talking to him off air. He thought he was going to do an hour interview. Well, ultimately, he could do about 16 interviews with me because he's such a great storyteller. So everyone needs to pick up the book for sure, and we'll talk about that more later on. But when we get back, more with Dave Hansen, I want to go into ultimately your professional career and then how you got the big break that made you who you are today. You walk down the street, you mention your last name, everyone will remember. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, Twitter, Total Tutor, or I'm sorry, Twitter, Total Tutor, and also LinkedIn, Neil Haley. And I'm with Dave Hansen from the movie Slapshot and also author his own memoir, which is an autobiography. It's really interesting in a lot of ways, Dave, to know where you're at. And I guess now we figured out you can write based on your academic scholarship from the first segment.
Yeah, isn't that surprising?
You've surprised me twice. First of all, you write. Second of all, that you're smart. So I guess next you'll be saying Professor Dave. Now, but when we continue, and when I did get to see your email, I thought, oh my, wouldn't that have been funny if he was a Dr. Dave Hansen? But when we're talking about the whole situation where you got discovered, juniors led to playing professional hockey, but minor league hockey, correct? That's where you went. That was your next trip.
Well, yeah, that's where I ultimately ended up my first year professional. But I got drafted, and at that time it was the World Hockey Association and the National Hockey League. They were kind of competing leagues. And Minnesota had a league right there in St. Paul called the St. Paul Saints. And ironically, the St. Paul Fighting Saints. And they had drafted me, and I went and signed with, and again, ironically, the general manager of St. Paul Saints was a former coach of the Minnesota Golden Gophers. So I signed with them, went to their training camp, and they sent me to a place that I had never heard of, but certainly for people in the know, recognize it as a pretty much famous city called Johnstown, Pennsylvania, known more than anything for the Johnstown floods that they've had over the years and flooded out the city. So that was their minor league farm team. That's where they sent me after training camp in St. Paul, and that's where I got my pro start.
Very interesting. So you ended up in PA, and when you were playing minor league hockey, was it as rough and tumble as they say in the movie, would you say?
Oh, I was. It was everything plus what you see in the movie. In fact, the movie, which a lot of our fans don't realize, is based on more fact than fiction. The team that we played for, the team that I was playing for in Johnstown, called the Johnstown Jets, was in probably the lowest, if you want to equate it to a ladder, it was the lowest rung on the ladder of professional hockey. So you had to be able to survive in that environment. And fortunately for me, you know, growing up where I did and playing the kind of style that I did and the things that I did growing up, which included, you know, a lot of neighborhood fights and physical play, allowed me to not only survive but kind of establish my role and hone my abilities that would, you know, allow me to carry on a professional career at all levels for the next 10 years.
Amazing. And so the stories are true. Oh, my. Because, again, talking about this, so you're playing in the minor leagues. Did you ever get your taste into the NHL at all, or did you get...
Yeah. In the 10 years that I played, I jokingly tell people, but it's a true fact. In the span of those 10 years, every professional league that existed in that 10-year span, I think I played in. Now, certainly that meant that there was quite a few minor league teams, but at the same time, I played in the WHA, which again, I guess you could equate it to the AFL and the NFL or the NBA and the ABA, when you had competing professional levels, leagues at that level, at the highest level. So I played, I spent a couple of years in the WHA, and I spent time in the NHL. In the NHL, I was with the Minnesota North Stars and the Detroit Red Wings. And in the WHA, I was with the Minnesota Fighting Saints, the Hartford Whalers, and the Birmingham Bulls.
Wow. Interesting, because, again, when we think about it, you only got a cup of coffee like in the movie. So, Dave, you're playing hockey. You're playing at a level. You're going from you have a tremendous story, anyone in minor leagues. And I think, Dave, I told you I was a professional wrestler. So minor league hockey is just like minor league professional wrestling. You go into these towns. You're lucky to have enough to even have a hotel room after a game or a match. So you have these diehard fans that go to each one of the events, and they're like towns are like 10 minutes away from each other in certain aspects. So a lot of the same ideas when we talk about minor league hockey. How did you get discovered from the movie? Tell us the story about that.
Well, in Johnstown, you know, it was and people who obviously know the movie will be able to relate to this. Johnstown was a steel mill city in a valley. The steel mills were kind of starting to shut down. The hockey rink and a team was kind of the focal point of the city. And the team that we had put together there was a tough, brawling type of team. You had three brothers that looked just like the brothers in the movie, because two of the brothers in the movie were the actual brothers for the Johnstown Jets. But you had Jeff, Jack, and Steve Carlson, three big, tough, long-haired Minnesota boys that wore the black rim glasses. And then you also had a character that's in a movie that's called Dave Killer Carlson. Well, in real life, for the Johnstown Jets, you had Dave Killer Hansen. And then all the other characters involved that were written into the script were, you know, based on a lot of characters on the team and in the league. So the short version of a long story was simply that first inaugural season, which was a 74-75 season in Johnstown, we brawled our way and played hockey to win the championship. And one of the players on the team was a guy by the name of Ned Dowd, a college boy, kind of like Ned Braden in the movie, college boy playing there, very, very smart, good college player, had a wife that wasn't too happy about being in Johnstown. Well, one night, this player, and his name is Ned Dowd, who also played the role of Ogie Oglethorpe in the movie, he has a sister that's a screenplay writer living out in Los Angeles. And one night, Ned gave her a call and started telling her all about where he was at. You know, I'm in this place. The steel mills are shutting down. He had to see these guys on this team. He got brawling brothers, a guy that called himself Killer. We ride the iron lung all over the East Coast. We were up in the stands the other day, had a big brawl in the stands. We had a big brawl warm up, and the team forfeited and wouldn't come out and play the rest of the game. And, you know, on and on. And then he says, but I think the team's going to be folding soon, you know, because the mills are shutting down. And her question was, well, who owns the team? And he says, well, I don't know. She ended up coming to Johnstown, follows around for quite a few weeks, and the light bulb went off, and she wrote a script about it all. So when they started that summer, which would have been the summer of 75, they started trying to cast actors, professional actors, to start playing these roles. And Ned Dowd actually got hired to be the guy to go out and try to find, you know, actors and teach these actors how to skate and do this and that. Well, they got people like Nick Nolte and Peter Strauss and Donnie Most and other professional actors that they wanted to play these roles, but they couldn't skate.
Oh, my.
Yeah, or at least they couldn't skate well enough to make sure that the action looks like real hockey action. In fact, I think Peter Strauss broke his ankle trying to skate. And so finally Ned just went to the movie people and said, you know, he says, this isn't working out. Why don't you go back to Johnstown and get a hold of the Carlson brothers and get a hold of Dave Hansen, and why don't you just let them play themselves in the movie, which were these, you know, the Hansen brothers are written after the Carlson brothers, and Killer Carlson was written after Dave Hansen. So they came back basically at the start of that season and sat us down and had us read a couple lines out of the script, which was a difficult task in itself, and said, well, we're gonna give it a go. Now, so the plan was to have Jeff, Jack, and Steve Carlson play the Hansen brothers, and I was going to play Killer Carlson, but Jack got called up to Edmonton about the time they got ready to start filming, and so they just plucked me out of my role, threw me in as a brother, and brought in Jerry Hauser to play Killer Carlson, and, you know, the rest on film.
Well, so again, right place, right time, because this really, again, the Hansen brothers, anything you mention, unless it's Paul Newman, people remember in Slapshot the Hansen brothers, because it's just so comical. I mean, when you took this role, and these guys, the Carlsons, were exactly, the twins were truly like this, these brothers. were
Well, they weren't twins. Again, there's three brothers.
Okay.
And they all were, you know, 1 year apart, just like in the movie. I think we say, yeah, Jack, you know, I'm 21, I'm in the middle, and Steve's older than me, and Jeff's a year younger. You know, that's the same way it was for Jeff, Jack, and Steve. They were all, you know, 20, 21, 22. And believe me, other than the glasses, obviously weren't that thick when they played, but it was, they wore the coal miner safety glasses when they played, and they were, and that was them. That was them to a T.
And you were a fighter like they were, or were they more fighters than you were when you were playing in the
no.
league?
Well, Steve was a playmaker. Steve was the youngest one in real life, and he didn't have to worry about fighting because he had Big Jack, who was 6'3", 215 pounds on his left wing, and Big Jeff, who was 6'3", 225 pounds on his right wing. And then you had Dave Hansen playing defense, who was 6'1", 200 pounds, and all three of us were fighters. And so, you know, Steve would just put the puck in the net, and if anybody got in his way, we were there to take care of business for him.
And I think the success of the movie also is because there's so many people that just go to hockey to watch the fights. And really, in the NHL, when the regular season goes on and the fighting's going on, it's the biggest highlights on SportsCenter and all places in between, and it's just part of the game. And that's
people often say the two times people stand up and cheer, one they either score a goal, two a fight breaks out. So it's an exciting part of the game. I mean, we won't get into this part, but you know, the game has changed obviously since back in the 70s, but fighting is still a part of it and still an exciting part of it.
Okay, we're talking to Dave Hansen from Slapshot, the movie, and also his book, Slapshot, the original. And Dave, I think the last thing is, I guess, how did it feel? Because I told you that we are close to running out of time. I guess the last question is, how did it feel being filmed for so long and being part of the movie process and being in that game compared to hockey, being in the movie and the whole ins and outs of it?
Well, when we shot the film, we shot it in the summer of 76. It came out I think February 77. So typically hockey players, at least it was with us, you know, you play a long season, especially in the minors, you're riding the bus a lot, you don't get to see the sun too often. You know, it turns into a very long season. So when the off season comes, let's spend the summer goal playing softball and drinking beer all summer long, get ready for next training camp. Well, in this case, it was, we're going to do a movie. So every day for 3 months, we were either up extremely early and spending all day on the set to late at night, or up all night filming at night and getting to bed early in the morning and sleeping all day. And although it started out as fun and it was extremely interesting, it got quite boring. You know, we got quite antsy having to sit around. So a lot of sitting and wait, but when you're shooting, a lot of fun. Paul Newman was just an awesome guy. We became very good friends, drank together, joked, pulled pranks together, laughed, and, you know, did those kind of things. And the whole set and everybody involved kind of just became very close and, you know, put together a film. So even though the experience at the time was, looking back, was a lot of fun, a great opportunity. I can tell you, in the moment at times, there was time where we were saying, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Because we're all playing softball and drinking beer.
But you became an icon because of it. Not many minor league / professional hockey players are an icon like you are. Now, I know with your relationship with Paul Newman, you decided to start a foundation when he passed on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the only part of the foundation that I had was just I saw this book as an opportunity to create a website and try to steer people towards Paul's foundation. You know, one of the neat things that we discovered when we got to meet Paul and become friends with him was just even though he was, you know, the iconic movie superstar himself, he was just a regular down-to-earth guy that had a big heart, very humble, and did things for the right reasons. And one of them was his hole-in-the-wall game that he started as a result of his food products. All the proceeds that came out of the Newman's own food products went directly to help critically ill children. And so I just thought that it was such a great foundation, and for such a great guy to do something that, if there's anything I can do to kind of contribute in my own little way towards that, I'd like to. So, you know, simply on my website, I just posted some information there that said, hey, you know, please go to this link and support Newman's website and anything that any sales that I get through that I can toss this way from the sale of my book, I'll do the same.
And that's tremendous. And so where, Dave, I can't believe we're running out of time, but where can we find information on you, purchase your book, and learn more about you?
Well, I think if you, you know, just go ahead and do the thing that most people do and Google Slapshot Original, the man, the foil, the legend, you'll have an opportunity to, you know, see where it's sold. It's sold in the major bookstores. You know, you can get it online with Amazon or go right through Triumph Books. So that's probably the best and quickest way. It just came out in paperback, so I think it's a little less expensive than the hardcover. So it's you know, for those people that enjoy the movie, it tells a lot of funny behind-the-scenes stories in there that I think they'll get a good chuckle. And if they decide after they read it they want to color in it, then, well, they can still do that too.
And your website again, Dave, is?
Good question. It's... Slapshotoriginal.com, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you Google it, yeah, and you can find it. Dave, it was fantastic. We're going to have a beer sometime, especially we're very close to each other, so we'll stay in touch. Love to have you back on in a couple months to just kind of trade another hockey story or another part of the movie, because there's so much more to talk about. I could talk to you for hours, so don't you say you're not a talkative guy. Dave is a talkative guy. He's a deep thinker. One of the Hanses is a deep thinker. Oh, my. But, Dave, thanks for calling, and we'll stay in touch, okay?
Well, Neil, I look forward to it, and I'll have a grape and an orange, none of that stinking root beer with you.
All right, sounds good. Okay, Dave,
right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network Celebrity Segment. Again, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And for my Pittsburgh affiliates, you guys got to be really excited to have this guy back on. And I wonder, last time he's talked to the Pittsburgh media before, but I want to welcome the program, Mike LaValliere, Golden Glove winner, Pittsburgh Pirate, and much, much more, a.k.a. Spanky. Mike, thanks for calling, man.
Neil, it's my pleasure to get a chance to speak with everybody.
Well, absolutely, Mike. It's just the memories of the Pirates of that time. And in our second segment, we're going to kind of rehash and talk a little bit about how great it's to see the Pirates, the resurgence of the Pirates. And I'm sure that makes you happy as well, to see the Pirates after so many years of having down times.
You know, Neil, even though I played with four teams, the Phillies signed me. I played with the Cardinals, then get traded to the Pirates and the White Sox. But I, you know, whenever I look back at my career, you know, I kind of identify myself as a Pirate, and I've moved here to Bradenton, the spring home of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and ended up coaching with them in spring training, you know, this past year, and working with the catchers. So, you know, I have to look back at it, and you know, even though I was a Cardinal, I was rooting a little bit harder for the Buckeyes.
Well, that's good. You're definitely getting some brownie points. So let's talk about, Mike, how you got discovered to get into the major leagues. Did you always think you were going to be a major leaguer? First of all, did you think?
Well,
that?
To tell you the truth, back in high school, I was probably a better hockey player than I was a baseball player. I grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, and had an opportunity to go up to play in the Junior A League as a high schooler, and chose not to because I would have had to quit baseball. So, you know, for a time there, it was, you know, really, I was my first love was hockey, and, you know, I really thought that's if I was going to ever make it to, you know, someplace, it was, you know, it was going to be in that sport. But, you know, I ended up, it worked out for the best, obviously, and I got a couple of breaks and, you know, took advantage whenever I had the chance.
Absolutely, and it's a situation. So you kind of got involved in baseball and stuff like that. When did someone discover you to kind of get to get that opportunity to be in baseball, or was it someone saying, you know, you got to change sports for sure?
Well, I tell you one thing, Neil. I went to college up in New England also, and you know, at the time back in the early '80s, late '70s, yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of guys coming out of there, you know, to play baseball. And in the draft of 1981, I believe there was 57 rounds, and I don't know at the time 28 teams possibly, and not one of them thought that I was good enough to play. And I ended up signing as a free agent. I was playing in the Cape Cod League. I still wanted to play. And, you know, I was having a fabulous time there. And, you know, I enjoyed school. And, you know, I was just, you know, going to see if, you know, possibly somebody, I could change somebody's mind maybe my senior year. And ended up having a good hot streak whenever there was a Philadelphia Phillies scout in town scouting us in the Cape League. And he ended up taking a liking to me and watched a couple games. I ended up going, I don't know, in the two games, 8-for-9 with a homer and a couple of doubles, some RBIs, some good defensive plays at third base, and he signed me right then and there, and yeah, that's where it all started.
Wow. It must be amazing to have that opportunity and say, oh my gosh, now I'm signed. You know, who would have thought I would be playing baseball? And so you're in the minor leagues. And once you're in the minor leagues, did you feel that you were going to get up to the majors quickly?
Well, my first spring training, they had told me that I was going to be, they were going to make me a catcher. And hadn't caught before, but kind of saw the writing on the wall at the time, especially in the early 80s. They got a guy named Mike Schmidt that was playing third base from Philly. And I figured, you know, maybe beating him out wasn't probably the easiest thing to do. So I went right along with it. And, you know, I had a couple of great guys, Rolly DeArmas, who's still with the Phillies organization, and P.J. Carey. These two guys worked with me in spring training. They taught me the right way to do things. And it was just, you know, I get some great coaching. I knew I had to push hard to make myself better, but I knew there was no chance I was going to make it to big leagues as a third baseman, so moving to catcher was the right thing to do, and it all worked out for the best.
And definitely worked out for the best. So when did you know you were finally going up to the majors? Getting the call, was that awesome?
Well, it was. I remember I started off the year, and it was kind of a weird year in 1984. I had started off the year by getting married. So we'll start with the real weirdness. Just kidding. We'll be celebrating my wife and I our 30th.
Congratulations! That's great.
This upcoming February. But yeah, I went to spring training. Was intent on making it to the AAA team, and ended up having a trade or two right at the end of the spring, and I got bumped back to AA. And I remember in the locker room, the minor league coordinator with the Phillies, Jim Ballmer, kind of sat me down and said, hey, look, you know, we really like you. We got a spot for you in the coach's room next year. Just go out and have a good year. So according to the Phillies, I was pretty much done, and they wanted to make me a coach. Well, I went back to AA. I was a backup catcher again. Ended up a couple guys get hurt, probably about 8 guys get hurt.
Wow.
Ended up going to AAA. Their guy, the starter in AA, they didn't feel he was ready, and I was. So I get up there and had an opportunity to catch every day for a month and a half, and really had a great month and a half. And Lee Elia was the manager in Portland. I was playing out in the Pacific Coast League, and I don't know exact the date, but it was right around October or August 20, last week of August, and he calls me into his office, and I'm thinking, man, you know, I've been behaving, you know, I'm having a good year. Is he going to chew me out for something? And so he sets me down and says, Spank, you're getting called up in September. And that was obviously pretty amazing. And you end up getting called up in September, and just, you know, for the basic warm up some pitchers and drink some big league coffee.
So when you get to Philadelphia, I have to jump back, because when you brought up Spanky, and I'm sure you were excited that I remembered that and brought that up, because again, it just brings back memories. Who gave you that nickname?
Well, actually, Jim Fregosi. He was my manager in AAA with the Cardinals. And actually, when Lee Elia called me in, my nickname with the Phillies was Bulldog. And so he called me Doggy. And so the next year, I end up getting traded to the Cardinals. And Fregosi looked at me and said, Spanky. And I said, well, what's up? He goes, well, you look just like the Little Rascals character. And I says, well, what if I don't like it? He goes, well, yeah, tough luck, kid. You know, that's the one that's going to stick. And that's the one that ended up sticking.
It definitely ended up sticking. So you played with the Phillies for how many years?
I was with them from 81 until 1984. Then went over to the Cardinals for 85 and 86. And then started my career with the Pirates in 87.
And that's what I really want to go to, is the Pirates. You had a feeling I would go there. Who, you know, those years in the Cardinals. So you were you a platoon player with the Cardinals?
Actually, I started off the year as the backup catcher in 1986. They traded for Mike Heath, and Ed Heathy was the starter. And, you know, things didn't work out for him. And about the middle of June, I was took over, and I was the everyday catcher in St. Louis in 86, and ended up playing, 110 games that year as a rookie.
Okay, so when you finally ended up with the Pirates, were you excited about going to this organization? Did you know a lot about the organization and its tradition and everything when you got the call up?
Tell you the truth, Neil, we were in last week a spring training with the Cardinals, and there was a B game early that morning, and there was only two catchers in camp because it's the very end. It was Steve Lake and myself, and Steve had caught 9 innings of the morning game, and so I'm getting ready for the afternoon game, the 1 o'clock game, and out in the outfield and doing my jogs and getting loosened up. And Dave Ricketts, the coach of the catching coach with the Cardinals, comes in and says, "You're not playing." And I said, "Well, what's going on? I'm fine." He goes, "You're not playing." That's all he told me. And then he grabbed Van Slyke and he says, "You're not playing, Andy." And so right then and there, it was kind of like, all right, what's up? And then they said, well, yes. And I go, well, who's going to catch? Well, Steve Lake. So here's a guy who's going to have to catch a doubleheader in spring training, which is, you know, a lot of guys don't catch doubleheaders right during the season, never mind spring training. So right then and there, I knew that I was traded. And so Andy and I talked to each other during the game, and we figured, you know what? There's only two places where we really didn't want to go. We didn't want to go to Montreal because of the hassles of going through customs, in and out of the country. And we didn't want to go to Pittsburgh because they had lost 100 games like 4 years in a row. And, things were just really not very good. initially, the trade was, it was someone, someone that had killed my dog. St. Louis, an absolute fabulous organization, great city. Here I am going from one of the best situations in baseball to, at the time, one of the worst situations. Went with an open mind. Jim Leland, the very first day, welcomes us into the locker room. And, he just said he made an instant impression, right there. And I says, well, you know what, playing for this guy, I don't know what else is going on. I didn't know anybody else on the team other than Andy. But, if everything's like this guy, things are going to be all right.
Well, absolutely, and getting to Pittsburgh and, again, a losing team. It kind of sounds like what we'll talk about for a couple minutes on this show because I'm so interested in the story, Mike. And when you come up with, what are we going to talk about? You see, it's like just you and I having a cup of coffee, learning about you and learning the background. I mean, the backup story, the background going to the Pirates. So once you get there, you're in almost the same boat as a lot of the Pittsburgh Pirates today that were winning. They were a terrible team. They were bottom feeders. I'm sure the crowds weren't very big at that time. But you went to, once you finally got to Pittsburgh, I'm sure you saw the tradition, right? You saw the fans.
Yeah. I mean, we had, good group of guys, and you could see that there was talent, but we made mistakes. We made young mistakes, and, that was the one thing is, we held each other accountable, and that's the kind of team we had. We were close really from the get-go, and, it was just kind of like everybody, had that goal of, number one, selfishly, to stay in the big leagues, but number two, let's make something out of this. And, it was just, everything, the kids, the wives, the coaches. It really was a family. And, I think that was a big part of the development of our success there was, everybody cared about each other. And, that's a big part of it, knowing that you're not all out there by yourself. You get somebody that's got your back.
So you turned it around pretty quickly, right? I'm kind of, being a historian, going back and remembering. I remember 91, 92, 89. So you got to the Pirates in what year?
I got there in 87. And, that year, I think we finished 80 and 82, so we're just slightly under 500. And then 88, we contended for a while, but the Mets were just too good. And 89, we went into that season thinking, all right, this is it. This is time for us to, jump up and play with the big boys. And we had a rash of injuries early in the year, and Sid Bream went down with a knee injury and missed three or four months. 2 days after he went down, I went down, had to play at the plate, and I missed 3 months. Vance Slyke, within 2 weeks, he hurt his back, and he ended up missing some significant time. So, 89 was kind of a mulligan, where, a lot of promise to start with, and, didn't keep the horses on the track. And, going into 90, we knew that, we still had the right pieces and we're all healthy. And that's really, when things started to gel.
All right, so when we get back, more of Mike LaValliere, Spanky, and we're going to go into specifically, I guess, your fondest memories in Pittsburgh. Then we're going to go into what your thought of this year's Pirate team was and next year, and then also life after baseball. You're listening to Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network celebrity segment. Again, you can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, or SimplyG.com. to find out information on G.J. Reynolds, the playful and powerful warrior. And I'm with Mike LaValliere, the great catcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates, a.k.a. Spanky, and we're learning about certain situations. So I could go into a story and we could talk about for hours. It's kind of funny. He said, you want me to prepare? I said, Mike, I will just talk Pittsburgh Pirate baseball with you. So I'm blue in the face, and I'll tell you my feelings, and I really want to air my feelings out on the radio regarding the Pirates and their resurgence. But talking about, what were your fondest memories in Pittsburgh?
Well, actually, there was, I'd have to say, there's three, games or events that stuck out, and actually two of them were away we clinched in 1990. We were actually at Busch Stadium. And that's the first time I had clinched to go on to postseason play. And I remember that feeling of, the excitement. We had a fabulous year in 90. Bonds ended up being MVP. Dravec was the Cy Young. We had finally gotten to where we needed to be. And I remember getting back home, and this is the second thing, being met at the airport, the old airport in Pittsburgh, yes, by thousands of fans, and this is, I don't know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if it was quite that late, but, that's the second thing. I mean, it was just, the first thing was the game. The second thing was the fans that night, and that was just, to me, it was just unbelievable. We went through the terminal, the buses, it couldn't move. There were so many people just jumping up and down. It was crazy. It was absolutely insane, and that really stuck out. And then, probably the last thing was the night that they closed Three Rivers. Had a big ceremony, and they brought a bunch of us back, and it was great to see a bunch of my old teammates, and it was a special time.
And the last question is, what makes Pittsburgh fans the greatest fans in the world? What do you think?
Well, I tell you, Neil, if there was a way of getting our winner here in Florida, in Pittsburgh, I'd live there in a heartbeat. And I think what makes Pittsburgh people great is, great fans is what makes them great people. And, they're hardworking, they're honest, they love a good day's work, and they appreciate a good day's work. And as a player, you go out there and bust your tail, you obviously want to be successful all the time. It doesn't happen. But I think the core people in Pittsburgh, and they've always been there. There was a lot more people that showed up this year. Yeah, but those core people have always been there. And it's down to earth. It's middle America. It's, yes, it's the Midwest. It's a great place to live, to bring up your kids. To me, it's just, fix the winter and I'm there in a heartbeat.
All right. Fantastic. So Mike, basically your take on the Pirates, then we'll talk about life after baseball. So basically we saw those last couple years of the Pirates, and I was just this naysayer saying, oh my gosh, come on now. Again, they're going to choke. And then this year it came back again. They came strong out the gates, and everyone thought they'd choke. What were you thinking, watching the Pirates and following them? What made them so special to get to this point? And I think they're going to go farther this year, I'm hoping.
Well, ultimately, Neil, you got to, I reference the horses. You got to have the horses to run the race. If you got a bunch of donkeys, you're not going to win. I don't care how hard they try. I don't care how good the jockey is. But unless you've got some thoroughbreds, you cannot win that race. And coming out of spring training, I think this is the first year in I don't know how long where they actually sent down to AAA some big league caliber guys. And to me, the depth of what I saw position-wise, and especially through the pitching staff. I remember the first day of pitchers throwing to hitters, and I walked around all the cages, and I looked, and I was thinking, if I was a player, and as a catcher, you can kind of pick your cage just to get your hits in. I don't know if I could find a comfortable at-bat. And, this is throughout, all these kids the kids were coming up from Double-A, the kids from Triple-A, the established big league guys. And I looked around, and I said, there's a lot of talent here on the mound. And to me, that's what you have to win. And I'm really, it's easy for me to say, but I wasn't surprised. They had more talent. They were deeper than they had ever been. They've knocked on the door the two previous years, but ultimately, they weren't deep enough. They didn't have enough horsepower. And this year, I thought they did. And they went in and improved it. You know, they've got a great staff. Clint does a great job preparing. He's got some great coaches working for him. You know, but, you know, the addition, you know, and to me, the biggest addition was Russell Martin. And I was speaking with Neil Huntington prior to one of the practices. And I says, Neil, you realize with that one acquisition, you made half your team better. And he said, what do you mean? And I says, well, you have 12 guys on your staff. With the addition of a veteran guy like Martin, who can block, he can throw, and he can handle the staff, he's going to make 12 guys better. And then it's an upgrade for what they had catching. That's 13 out of your 25 guys that were better, just with the one acquisition. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that was coming out of the spring. I wasn't surprised at all.
Do you think that they're going to be able to repeat this, or do you think with a small market it's so difficult?
Well, you know what? There's a lot of things that have to happen. Obviously, health is the number one concern. They had guys get hurt last year, but again, they were deep enough and they were able to fill those gaps. When Grilly went down, Melanson came in and did a fabulous job as the closer. They're going to have to stay healthy. You're not going to be able to miss McCutchen for a great deal of time. You can't miss Pedro Alvarez for a long time. I mean, you're going to have your big guys stay healthy. But that's true with every team. You look at what the Angels went through when Pujols went down.
Right.
They're just if your show ponies aren't there, you can't win.
All right, so we'll see if this happens. We'll look at injuries this year if the Pirates don't go where they need to go. Now, Mike, what's going on with you? You were talking about you're involved with ESPN. So you're staying busy after retirement, involved in baseball still in certain aspects. Tell us what's going on with you.
Well, I've been doing some regional broadcasting with Bright House Networks here, doing high school and USF, and doing some college games. Did a couple of Florida State, Florida, and Miami games, and then I get contacted by ESPN3 over in Orlando, and from June until the end of September or early August or early October, I head over to Orlando and I call some youth league games, a lot of all-star competitions, major tournaments, World Series from the different groups of the AAU and other groups that come up to Disney, and anywhere from ages 8 to 18, and had the opportunity to call some fast pitch girls major tournaments too, and it's fun. The kids are exciting. They make some mistakes like all kids do, but the effort is there every single day. It's fun to watch.
Well, that's great to hear. Are you basically anything else? Any other projects you're doing, or pretty much just for ESPN right now?
Well, I'm going to probably help out with our local high school. They just got a new coach, and he's actually a kid that I helped coach when he was younger. And Donnie Robinson, my very good friend, is going to be the pitching coach. So, yeah, we're going to help out. It's Manatee High School, which is pretty much known for their football. But we're going to see if we can help out the baseball program. And also, we'll see what happens. See if Mr. Hurdle and Mr. Huntington can use me again for the spring.
Well, I hope so, and then we'll have to have you back on to give us a prediction and what you were able to experience over there with the Pirates. It's so fantastic. Mike, I tell you, I see bigger things for you. You're such a colorful guy, more than just ESPN3. So I'm going to keep rooting for you to get that next opportunity, because you seem very down to earth. You seem very interested and very knowledgeable. So I'm very impressed by you, and I hope that you get some opportunities to call in the biggie leagues someday too. I think that would be great for you. So we'll see.
Well, Neil, I certainly appreciate the kind words, and my wife is rooting for me to be out of the house a little bit more often too.
So we don't have a website or anything, Mike. We could just wiki you, right? Is that pretty much the best way to find information on you?
That's about it. I mean, I'm not much for the papers. I do a whole lot of stuff online and getting on stuff on the internet and reading. That's how I do my research. So that's pretty much. I think that's the way of the world now.
Well, Mike, best of luck to you. We'll definitely stay in touch. And if you're in Pittsburgh, we got to have a cup of coffee when you come to Pittsburgh again, for sure.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Neil, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for including me the opportunity to share my story with everyone.
Well, absolutely, Mike. Good talking to you. And you have a great story. Think about writing a book as well. You have some interesting story. You're a great storyteller. Definitely think about that. And that'll get you busy too, Mike. So we'll think about that one as well. But thanks again for calling, man.
Okay, thanks again.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, that was Mike LaValliere. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment.